Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
CFRC from Kingston, Ontario. Your volunteer program, campus and community radio at 101.9 FM and on the web at cfrc.ca.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. After a long discussion at their June 17th meeting, council ultimately voted to rename Indian Road. Indian Road runs through a residential community located in Strathcona Park, with approximately 62 households. The motion claims the name is in violation of the Civic Addressing and Road Naming Bylaw, which prohibits names that are discriminatory, offensive, or derogatory. The motion was put forward by Councillor Gregory Ridge, prompted by a request from Indian Road resident Daniel Shipp. Shipp, who has lived on the street for nearly a decade, addressed council before their discussion.
In my opinion, the street name is not only outdated, it's offensive and derogatory. Due to its complex and often paternalistic colonial history, it's very much out of step with our municipal street naming policy.
Brandon Maracle, Executive Director of Kingston Native Centre and Language Nest, an organization that was consulted by Councillor Ridge, also spoke before council.
Anything that exists in culture and society is something that we interact with, whether Indigenous or not. I think, like I mentioned previous, Indian is a complicated one. And when you see that on a road sign, you're met with your entire context as you go into that. That could be that it's the legal term. That could be that you're excited because you use that language, that term as a reclaimed word within community. Or, like I said, it could be a term of pain. Representing a community within Kingston from the Kingston Native Centre and Language Nest, all those perspectives are seen. And so it's hard to... What I'm really excited about is the consultation process.
Councillor Ridge introduced the motion, leading with the results of his discussions with several local Indigenous organizations and Indian Road residents, and clarifying the intention of the change.
There are differing opinions on this matter, but the overwhelming majority of those who I had the honor of listening to were in favor and in support of this change. We must also be careful to continue listening and to continue to be supportive as we move forward. Finally, I want to mention something. This motion is not the result of liberal guilt, nor is it the result of wokeness. This motion is not intended to open a larger debate about naming public spaces, but instead to point to a singular matter that requires addressing. To the people who are concerned that we're trying to change history, we can't. Nobody can change history. But we can and must try to make today and tomorrow better for everybody in our community.
Strathcona Councillor Jeff McLaren, however, represented a different perspective. McLaren argued that the people who developed the area decades ago chose the name to recognize the contributions of Indigenous people in Canada, pointing to several other streets in the neighborhood referencing Indigenous history and culture, including Arrowhead Place and Mohawk Place. He also argued that the city has not done enough consultation on the matter and should take a step back before deciding if the name should be changed. At the start of the meeting, he presented a petition started by a resident against changing the name, which garnered 40 signatures from residents of the street. McLaren suggested 3 amendments to the motion.
So, this motion is before us now, even though I had hoped it would not be. And it is possible to make this supportable. There just are a few small changes that need to be made, I think, that would be more respectful and more in line with true reconciliation.
The first 2 amendments, which passed unanimously, were to consult a list of local Indigenous groups and First Nations with a connection to the area on the matter, and to ensure that the history behind Indian Road be preserved and commemorated in some way. However, his 3rd amendment, suggesting they step back to consult further on whether the name should be changed at all, sparked more debate.
We cannot presume to know the answer to consultations before we do the consultation. This motion, as written, presumes that we're going to change the name because certain people that we've talked to already have said so. Perhaps the frame was correct, perhaps the frame was wrong. I don't know. But the consultation needs to be wide and far apart. If it comes back, having done that, that the majority want this changed, I will support that. But I support that theory that nothing about us without us should be first and primary. This is actually, in fact, how you build trust.
Councillor Connie Glenn supported the amendment.
Councillor Ridge has gone and talked to some people. Councillor McLaren has gone and talked to some people. I've heard some things, you've heard some things. So as we make this kind of a decision, because of the cultural impact, because of the sensitivity around it, I think maybe taking a step back to allow people to say, do we really consider this word this way? I'm hearing mixed things. So let's do a fulsome consultation and get it right.
Councillor Ridge and Councillor Brandon Tozzo, who seconded the motion, found this strayed too far from the original intention to move forward with the name change.
The amendment is contrary to the intention of the motion, which is to begin the renaming process. This is to change that to considering renaming. One may argue that actually could be called out of order, but I'm not going to do that.
I think this runs extremely contrary to that motion, and I think we kind of have to make a decision whether we want to go forward with this or whether we don't. And if we don't want to go forward with renaming the road, I think the option is just to vote it down. So I'm going to vote down this amendment.
The amendment was ultimately voted down, and the decision on whether to rename the road or leave it be was before council. Councillors McLaren and Glenn both agreed that satisfactory consensus has yet to be reached.
The answers that we're going to get have already been selected. It doesn't matter what Indigenous people now say. It doesn't matter what the residents now say. The motion has presumed that there's going to be a name change. And that is paternalistic.
It's a matter of how we go about doing this. And we have to consider the how as much as we consider the what. And maybe this is where this wasn't where we should have been. Maybe we should have had other conversations about it before the motion got to the floor. Maybe there should have been a broader bit of conversation between all of us about what this actually means. I actually think the likely outcome in the long run will be probably a name change, but one that the community will agree with. And consensus building matters in these situations. And I don't think that we're going to build consensus this way. I'm concerned, actually, that we might pit people against one another. So I think I'm going to vote against this motion on that basis alone, that if this how was different, I would have been able to support this.
However, Councillors Tozzo and Vincent Chinnani stressed the need to move forward.
There's a saying by an abolitionist that I rather like, that history, the arc of history is long and it bends towards justice. That's quite optimistic. I don't know if that's always true, because I think it needs to be nudged every now and again. And I think sometimes as political leaders, we have to take that risk and nudge it along the way and try to do the right thing and have some form of justice, however that may be.
So I am going to vote in favor of this, because I think it's important to right wrongs that were done in the past. Even though the intent was good, To me, it feels like in today's society, you have to make that change to move forward, and then so people can feel like they heal. I've talked to a lot of people, and this is a very derogatory word, and there was people surprised that this is even the name of a street here.
Ridge capped off the discussion reading a letter from a resident of Indian Road.
I am not a cancel culture person, and I am not saying that we need to pretend the word Indian doesn't exist. But what I do believe is that having a street in your city named after a word that has come to have derogatory connotation for most people is not a way to commemorate Indigenous history or celebrate current Indigenous communities. I firmly support changing the name to something beautiful that has accurate historical and current meanings. I think what most residents are wary of are the administrative hurdles of changing everything related to your address. The city needs to walk residents through this and make it as streamlined and easy as possible. That inconvenience should not be a reason to keep the current name. I really see this as a microcosm of reconciliation in general. We should not be held back because the task seems too expensive or complicated. I love our street. It is home to wonderful people. I want a name that reflects this.
In the end, council voted 7-3 to rename the road. City staff will begin the consultation process for choosing a new name and report back by mid-2026. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell with your sports report for Monday, June 23rd, 2025. After a dramatic back-and-forth Game 7 that served as a microcosm of sorts for the broader series, the Oklahoma City Thunder, led by Canadians Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Lou Dort, took home the Larry O'Brien Trophy last night. The Indiana Pacers and the Oklahoma City Thunder had very different journeys to the NBA Finals. The 68-win Thunder were the NBA's top seed and swept their way through their first-round series against the Memphis Grizzlies, won a hard 7-game series against the Denver Nuggets, before cruising to a 5-game victory over the Minnesota Timberwolves. The Pacers, on the other hand, became renowned for their last-second playoff comebacks, led by their superstar point guard Tyrese Halliburton. The matchup between superstar point guards was one with a great deal of stylistic differences. Tyrese Halliburton is an excellent half-court operator who plays very team-friendly basketball, whereas Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is better as an isolation scorer. In terms of team philosophies, Indiana is a great offensive unit, whereas Oklahoma City is one of the best team defensive units in NBA history. This was a thrilling series from start to finish, but unfortunately, Game 7 will be forever left in the what-if category. Because early in the first quarter, superstar point guard Tyrese Halliburton suffered a pretty serious Achilles injury, not only knocking him out of the game, but possibly putting his 2026 season in jeopardy. The Oklahoma City Thunder were able to capitalize on this injury to take home the second NBA title in franchise history and the first in Oklahoma City by a score of 103-91, with Hamilton's own Shai Gilgeous-Alexander taking home Finals MVP. This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Beginning with Monday, June 23rd, we're going to see a daytime high of 26, but it'll feel closer to 32. As such, a heat warning has been put in place for Kingston and the surrounding area. That will continue into Tuesday, June 24th, daytime high of 29, feeling closer to 35 out in the sun. So take your time, take it easy, and stay cool. Wednesday, June 25th, it cools off ever so slightly, daytime high of 26 with cloudy conditions. And moving into Thursday, June 26th, we have a daytime high of 23, but a 60% chance of precipitation, which is expected to cool conditions slightly here in the city of Kingston. That rain will give way to thunderstorms on Friday, June 27th. Same daytime high of 23 degrees, but a 70% chance of precipitation and thunderstorms into the afternoon. We're going to see a potential for thunderstorms on Saturday, June 28th. Same daytime high of 23 and about a 60% chance of storms throughout the day. Moving towards the end of the weekend, Sunday, June 29th, conditions warm up slightly going back to 25 degrees, and we're going to see a lot of cloud cover here in the city of Kingston. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, June 30th, daytime high of 24 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway's summer and fall closure schedule has been updated by Public Services and Procurement Canada. Reminder that the summer dates of the LaSalle Causeway's closure are as follows: July 1st, 6th, 13th,
20th and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, and September 7th, the causeway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on each of those summer dates. As for the fall, the current dates are September 21st, October 5th, 14th, and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th, the time of closure being 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on each of those dates. Here are this week's relevant road closures. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29 for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Here are some ongoing delays to be aware of. Abbeydon Road, middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Florida Road, Henderson to Wilton, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Now coming up are the main events happening around town this week. On Monday, game night is back at One Eye Jack's Restaurant and Bar starting at 7 p.m. Hosted by the Bored Bartender, it's an evening of trivia, brainbusters, and board games paired with dinner and drinks. On Tuesday, head to Kingston Literacy and Skills for the official launch of Word Labs, a new community writing program. From 7 p.m. to midnight, enjoy a free evening of readings, roundtable chats with local writers, tours, and meet and greets. On Wednesday, the Ground Up Dance Festival kicks off at Lake Ontario Park. Running until July 12th, it features free performances, classes, and pop-up dance happenings around town. It's all ages and all styles. Or from 7 to 8:30 p.m., join the Fiercely OK Weekly Song Circle at Chalmers United Church. Led by Steph Druin and Paul Barton, it's a welcoming $20 drop-in for anyone who wants to sing in harmony and build community through music. No experience needed. On Thursday, the Spare Some Hope Bowl-a-thon is at Splitsville, Kingston. Sessions run from 4 to 6 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. with bowling, snacks, raffles, and prizes to support food and housing programs through Lionhearts Inc. Tickets are $30 or $170 for a team of six. Also Thursday, Art Noise hosts Life Drawing from 6 to 8 p.m. with a nude male model. Doors open at 5:30 and it's a $10 drop-in open to all levels. Later, check out No Effing Rules, What's Your Talent? At La Vida Bistro Bar. Hosted by local comic Ryan James, this open mic meets talent show starts at 7 with doors at 6. Or if you're in the mood to sing, karaoke at Tiernanog runs from 9 to midnight and it's always free and fun. On Friday, Buckle Karaoke kicks off at 9 p.m. and goes until 12:30 a.m. It's free to join and always a good time. Over at the Grad Club, the Ottawa Invasion hits the stage from 8 to 11:30 p.m. with drag stars Josephine J and MX Caligula. It's a 19-plus event full of drama, camp, and fierce performances. Tickets start at $11.98. Feeling groovy? The Pride Glide Roller Disco is on at the Memorial Center from 7 to 9 p.m., hosted by Quad Squad and DJ Tiger Styles and photographer Liz Cooper. It's $22.63, and skate rentals are available if you book ahead. Or head to the Yoga Loft YGK for a sound immersion experience with Mahela Sanchu from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. Tickets are $25 for this relaxing, meditative session of healing sound. On Saturday, don't miss the Island Talk speaker series at Hotel Wolf Island. From 11 a.m. to noon, journalist John Loring will speak on his new book, No Jews Live Here, exploring how fascism grows in communities. It's a free event on the waterfront patio with a signing to follow. And wrapping things up on Sunday, stroll through the AWEC Summer Pop-Up Market from 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Confederation Park. This vibrant outdoor event showcases women-led businesses with art, fashion, food, and more. It's free, festive, and open to everyone. Have a local event you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca. Hey folks, I'm Ellie Sturton, and coming up are your concerts for the week. On Monday, Jazz Society Mondays runs from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the RCHA, with early jazz by Michael K. Myers and Rick Flanagan. It's just $5 at the door. Also Monday, Sober is the New Cool brings live music and mocktails to the Creekside Bar and Grill from 5 to 10 p.m. with Christopher Jackson and Chris Murphy. All ages are welcome for a $10 admission. On Tuesday, join Afternoon Hang and Jam with John Torres from 1 to 3 p.m. at Rosewell Rehearsal. Admission is $10, it's BYOB and bring your own instrument, but snacks are provided. Then at Noab's Indian Sports Bar, open mic with Carrick McAllister runs from 7 to 11 p.m. and it's free for all ages. On Wednesday, Peter Van Huffel's avant-garde quartet, Callisto, hits the RCHA from 7 to 10 p.m. Tickets are $15 at the door. Euphoria, a queer drag celebration, takes over the grad club at 8 p.m. with hosts Sherry Ann Hex and Blow Pony. Cover for that one is $15. Or in Springer Market Square, enjoy free big band classics at 7 p.m. with the Taylor Donaldson Orchestra for the launch of Swingin' Summer. On Thursday, jazz trio Beats Workin' returns to the RCHA from 7 to 10 p.m. Cover is just $5. Or at the Cove Inn, catch Brock Zeman from 5 to 8 p.m. for a Roots Rock birthday show. Entry is by donation. And at the Toucan, Michelle Owen and the Works bring the Pop Rock Party from 10:30 to 2 a.m. On Friday, KPP Concerts presents Housewife Luella and Jessica Wolowicz at the Broom Factory at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $15. At the Mansion, catch Burning Tree, the Healy Brothers, and Why Go from 8 to midnight for alt-rock, blues, and pop. Tickets are $15 at the door. Amber Humbley performs at the Opinicon from 6 to 9 p.m. as part of their free summer series. And over at the Toucan, Monic, Neon Ghost House, Echoes, and Yes Please, and the No Thank Yous take the stage from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. Also on Friday at Base 31, Ella Be Good, a tribute to the First Lady of Song, starts at 7:30 p.m. with tickets from $39 to $59. The Spire is hosting Pretzel Logic, a Steely Dan tribute, also at 7:30 p.m., and tickets are $55.25. Outdoors in Springer Market Square, Abby Stewart performs from 7 to 8 p.m. as part of Kickin' It Country, with free line dancing beforehand. And at Tiernan Oak, Tyler Brett Forks plays folk country from 9 p.m. to midnight. It's 19-plus and free. On Saturday, celebrate 12 years of the Big Fat Horn Band at the RCHA from 8 to 11 p.m. with guest Jasmine Wobodich. Tickets are $30 at the door. From 11:30 to 3:30, enjoy Saturday sessions in Confederation Park with free live sets across the genres. Or folks can catch Emma Worley and Claire Hunter at Hotel Wolf Island from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. for a free evening of folk pop. Over at McKinnon Brothers Brewery, Brass Over Tea Kettle plays from 1 to 4 p.m. with bold brass and cold beer. And if you're in the mood for a festival, day one of the Power of Positivity Musical Harvest kicks off at Line Spike Frontenac from 12 to 11 p.m. with Walks of the Earth, Chantal Kraviazic, and more. Tickets range from $99 to $400. And for the Night Owls, Sweet Pea and the Heat bring rock and blues to the Toucan from 10:30 p.m. to 2 a.m. Finally on Sunday, head to Finkel's Shore Park for live music Sundays with Lucanus Pell at 2 p.m., Ethan Crosby at 3, and Courtney Kane at 4 p.m. And day two of the Power of Positivity Festival features Cassador, Grievous Angels, Tom Green, Kelsey Mayne, and the headliner, Burton Cummings, running from noon to 11 p.m. And at the Toucan, don't miss the Gertrudes from 5 to 8 p.m. for their signature Kingston sound. Have a local concert that you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by rockers The Winter in Canada called Wolves. This high-octane alt-rock track with punk edges and soaring vocals balances raw fury with undeniable hooks. Built on distorted guitars, driving bass, and thunderous drums, Wolves captures the chaos and clarity of confronting the people in power and realizing they'll let you down. Fans of Foo Fighters, Soundgarden, and Queens of the Stone Age will feel right at home with The Winter in Canada, known for their raucous live sets and blazing musicianship. Their new single, Wolves, is a statement of intent, loud, passionate, and impossible to ignore. Stay tuned for their new album to be released in July. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Wolves by The Winter in Canada on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us here now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Yeah, let's go.
These technocrats.
Hey, Kingston families, looking for an unforgettable summer adventure for your kids? Look no further than Assas Camps right on Queen's University campus. Assas Camps offers English and French programming for children ages 4 to 12. Campers participate in crafts, games, experiments, field trips, and activities with special weekly guests. Assas staff ensures a safe, packed summer with memories that'll last a lifetime. Spots are filling up fast, so register now at assascamps.ca.
CFRC 101.9 FM is so thrilled to announce the launch of our brand new accessible website at cfrc.ca. Get your local news, stream your favorite shows, and stay up to date with upcoming events. You can share news tips, book a recording studio, request a PSA for airplay, and oh so much more. CFRC.ca was made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada and our amazing funding drive donors. Thank you so much.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 271. On the broadcast today, I'm going to be speaking with independent filmmaker Frank Lopez. Frank speaks about a recent effort that he has been undertaking to document land-based struggles of the Nedisu, which is an indigenous community located in territories that are today called Quebec. This is a community also known as the Atikamekw. This community has a number of points of resistance to clear cutting. This is Quebec-based companies like Arbec and other major producers of wood for construction and other industries who are doing massive clear cuts on the traditional territories of the Nedisu. And there has been in recent years a number of important road blockades that have been put up by Indigenous land defenders in this area. So we're talking about a region that is in the north central part of Quebec, close to the city of Latuk, and very particularly not far from the small town of Parent, where there's a pulp and paper mill. Around this region, Nedisu land defenders have been blocking at various times huge industry logging trucks. And Frank Lopez, a filmmaker who's living outside of the city of Montreal in Quebec, more north, has been going to document these land-based struggles and has been sharing these films in the context of both community events and also in the context of the community trying to get the word out. I would note that this is a very underreported story, so I'm really happy to share this interview with filmmaker Frank Lopez. You can learn more about his work at amplifierfilms.ca, where you can also get the info about these particular films looking at the frontline road blockades and resistance of the Nedisu Indigenous community. So here's my conversation with Frank Lopez for Free City Radio. Frank Lopez, you've been making efforts for some time to try to communicate through video and film different land-based struggles of Indigenous communities, often on the sort of front lines of where sort of basically neo-colonial capitalist infrastructure is digging into Indigenous land, whether it's to dig out trees, whether it's to build a pipeline, to create mining projects. And these are projects taking place where you have, you know, significant opposition from Indigenous community elders and also people across generations. So you've drawn people's attention in this recent project to a situation about 4 hours north of Montreal. Please correct me on timing, where you have a frontline context of an Indigenous community that has been opposing essentially clear-cutting backed by the Quebec government on their territory. So, Frank, if you could just locate us by a brief introduction and then just a breakdown, you know, just on a basic level about this recent set of short films you've made about indigenous blockades and protests of clear cutting on their land.
Yeah, it was sort of serendipitous. I recently, in 2021, I moved to La Naudière. I was thinking to myself, wow, what a relief to be out here in the country to weather the pandemic, you know, and to have a little bit of chill time to myself and to with my family and sort of get acquainted with this region. And lo and behold, not even a couple of weeks after moving in, folks from the Nerissou community close to where I live, which is Manouan, is the reserve, threw up a blockade to bring attention to the logging in that community. And so really this began right now it'll be a 5-year relationship with this community, well, members of this community that are essentially pretty angry that there's no limit to the logging that's happening there. And then sort of all of this came to a head a couple of years ago when a company, in order to access a big lot that they wanted to log, they cut a bunch of maples. They cut a chunk of maple trees to build a road to access this. And for a lot of people who don't know, the Nerissou, just like many indigenous nations from around here, harvest the maple water in the spring. And this was a big part of their yearly harvest that was gone. And so there was another blockade that was thrown up there. And so what's been happening is that every spring, I've been going up. I would get these calls sort of last minute. And it's like, we threw up a locate. Can you please come here and document? And so through doing this work, we connected with another community in Wemontashi, who are much farther away from where we are. I think they're like 6 hours from where I live in La Naudière. And they were facing a similar situation. They had started blockades the year before, but I couldn't get out there, and they were calling for support again. And a friend of mine and I went, and there was a couple of more supporters from Montreal. But for the most part, it was just folks from the community who were there blocking a road that facilitated for workers to go to a bunch of different logging zones. And it's not that they were blocking altogether, but they were making it very hard for them to get there. So if they couldn't get through that road, they would be adding like 3 hours or so to their travel time. And so it was a bit of an annoyance, but for me, it was like very, very eye-opening, because on that day, the Atikamekw land defenders, land defenders, were met with a bunch of very angry forestry workers or loggers, however you want to call them, including also the management of the company, who were very angry. And I witnessed a lot of racism very openly being yelled at these land defenders. And they were vastly outnumbered. I'm not going to say that there could have been violence, but it definitely felt like a dangerous situation. The Quebec police was there, the Sûreté de Québec, the SQ, and the SQ basically was there observing, much to the chagrin of the owners of the company, who were asking for the land defenders to be arrested. So from that, a short video report was created, and it had an impact. It's pretty amazing how these things can actually make a difference, particularly because since these regions are so far away, the media doesn't always get there, and sometimes it's up to people like me who are independent, who have, you know, a little chunk of time to actually shine a light on these things. And so they were very pleased with that, and so they invited us to a second time to go back, but this time they took us to a lot of the logging sections, and they wanted us to document that, to fly the drone over them and see how much things are cut. And it was astonishing. And I think that, you know, people will observe from the video also the large wood piles that are left behind and that are being turned into wood for construction. It's a massive zone, and the Department of Forestry in Quebec really wants companies to ramp up the logging even more. It's a dire situation considering where we are ecologically with the planet, particularly the loss of biodiversity, the fact that forests are burning uncontrollably, and you know, like we're seeing animals disappear right before our eyes. And for the Netisu, this is all part of their way of life, and that is being stolen from them as well. So yeah, this is why we do what we do, and you know, I think I would close by saying that my hope is that people with the skills or with the time could go support actions like these, not only as media workers, which is actually massively important, but also as you know, people as warm bodies, as solidarity, you know, bring resources and whatnot. And what I usually tell people is that these are really great opportunities to get to know folks in these communities, where these opportunities don't really, they're not really available to us that often. And blockades are, there's a lot of dead time, and there's a lot of time to talk and get to know each other. And so these are opportunities that really people need to grab them and understand the importance of them.
The last point you mentioned, I think, is so important. I've been also in different blockade contexts, and the conversation and trust building that happens is just totally different. You're not on the screen, A, and B, you're outside of sort of capitalist time, in a sense. You're shutting down capitalism, you know, in some shape or form. That's pretty meaningful and moving context and comment. So thank you. Can you just locate us a bit more geographically where you're talking about and describe a little bit more of the footage that you're sharing in these videos and sort of what you were trying to illustrate by sharing this footage and sort of the urgency of the issue?
Well, Montachi is north of Latuk. If you look at a map of Quebec, I guess you will get heading up to Saguenay, and then and taking the road to Latuk, and then Latuk is the last settler town. So it's a pretty big city. Like there's a pulp mill there, so you know you can really tell by the stink that you got to Latuk, because there's all this smoke being generated by the pulp mill, and then the road ends. And so then you're taking a logging road, I think it's for 65 or 70 kilometers. And so it's pretty stunning, not stunning, it's pretty shocking, I would say, that you're going through this logging road, and it's very wide. And the reason why it's wide is because they need to make it wide for all the logging trucks that are going to be bringing the wood out. It's fairly well maintained, and so people can actually go fairly faster, and you see the logging trucks, you know, going down like 100 kilometers per hour, filled with the wood that they took from the forest. And from that moment on, you start seeing clear cuts all the way up till you get to Wemontashi, which is the reserve where this particular Netisu community is from. And the reserve itself is small. You know, there's some services there, but you definitely see like the poverty that's there as well. You know, this is the piece of land that was given to them by the government. And but as soon as you leave from the reserve and actually flying a drone is an incredible tool, because once you fly up, you can see how beautiful this area is. It's just nothing but woods, rivers, and lakes. It's just stunning. And these folks started blocking the road and set up a checkpoint at a road that leads to a town called Paran. And Paran, like parent in English. And Paran is the home of a very massive wood mill, owned by Arbec. This is basically like a super highway for moving workers into and out of logging zones. And so blocking this road was fairly significant, but it's pretty interesting that you see that nobody wants to really exacerbate the situation by arresting any of the land defenders. I've never seen anything like this, to be completely honest. And having private conversations with people tell me that the SQ really watches what they do ever since the Oka crisis, the so-called Oka crisis in Ganasetagi and close to Montreal. The mayor of Latouk, the settler community that I spoke of, was fairly angry because he expected the cops to act, and the cops are just, you know, passing the baton. They're saying like, no, this is not our deal. This is the provincial government, the provincial government, and the provincial government says like, no, it's the federal government, and so nobody wants to touch it. And so it provides these land defenders with a unique opportunity to make some headway in their struggle. It was very inspiring to see them, like, you know, once again take ownership of their land. It was as a decolonizing moment as I have ever witnessed in person. And they will go into the offices of Arbeck and demand to see the logging plans, demand to ask who gave permission to log in certain zones. It project a certain authority, not in the authoritarian way, but in the, like, you know, people know that this is their land, and so when they come through, people listen and stop what they're doing and pretty much get out of their way.
We will link to these films also for people to learn more and to engage with them. So 2 points quickly. You mentioned the Oka crisis of 1990, which basically saw indigenous land defenders blocking an attempt to build a golf course on a traditional burial site of members of the Six Nations community in Ganasetagi. So people might be familiar a bit more with the geography and the indigenous community present in that context. Can we just return back, if you could explain to us a bit more about, because you talked about an indigenous reserve close to Perron in Quebec, Parent in Quebec, Perron. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about the makeup of the indigenous community, just so people can understand where you're talking about and also which community it is? Thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So if you follow the Saint Laurent River towards Quebec City, what used to be a Haudenosaunee territory, well, what is Haudenosaunee territory, sort of peaks out like north of Montreal, right? And around there is where Nerissou, or most commonly known as Atikamekw territory, begins. And it's a large piece of land about the size of Austria. The Nerissou were given three different reserves in which to have their communities, and one is Manawan, the other one's Wemontashi, and the third one I'm going to have to tell you later because I don't remember offhand. It's pretty striking because in these communities, they're fairly isolated. Like, they're in the middle of the woods. You have to go through, for all three, you have to go through logging roads to get to them. So it's access to different things is fairly hard for these communities. These are communities that are very poor, where there's, at least in Wemontashi, I know there's a housing crisis there. Like, there's not enough homes to shelter everybody in the community. But also it's very striking that the Nerissou still speak their language. It's actually the first language, and French being their second one. And for me, that's extremely powerful because in other communities that are losing their language, maybe it's a positive effect of them being isolated is that they actually kept their maternal tongue, and that's what all the children speak it. Everybody speaks it, and you can tell that French is not their everyday language because it's as a second language as it is to me, or a third language as it is to me. It's a community that's very much in tune with their traditions and with nature, and you know, just like a lot of different communities, you know, there's always a tug of war between the band councils and the traditionalists, you know, when it comes to, like, you know, creation of jobs versus protection of the environment, which is very important to them. And so right now, Manwan is the reserve that's closest to Montreal. So it's you know, if you can find Saint Michel de Saint on a map, I guess it will be about 4.5 hours, 5 hours from Montreal, and then the next one is Wamonteshi. And close to Manwan and close to the town of Saint Michel de Saint, they're also starting not a lithium mine, but it's a material that's used for building batteries, it's ironically the company who's building it is called Nouveau Monde, New World Mining. Obviously, that's a reference to Christopher Columbus, which is, you know, the original colonizer. Which, I mean, I don't know if the company actually has any clue that they just really gave us a very easy thing to point out, but that's what it is. And I think that a point of reference for folks about the Nerissou is a very sad story. Ishakwan family is one of the families of Manwan. Their daughter, Joyce, was in a hospital in Joliet. This is the closest hospital that they have. It's about 3.5 hours from where they are. Joyce was in this hospital, and she was really badly mistreated by the staff there. And Joyce recorded the racism that was directed towards her. And sadly, Joyce died in the hospital. And this sort of launched the Atikamekw to ask for justice for Joyce became like the rallying cry. And I have to say, I've been to a bunch of indigenous led marches in my life while I've been in so-called Canada, but I went to one march led by Atikamekw folks in Trois-Rivières, and I've never been to an indigenous solidarity march where the majority of the people were indigenous, at least not in so-called Canada. And that was extremely powerful. And most people were Nerissou. So it's a community that, you know, might not have the longest history of resistance, but that they're finding their voice in the face of, you know, these injustices. And I think that people should follow them and support them and help in their struggles.
Thank you so much for outlining that, Frank. So Manwan community is part of the Atikamekw Indigenous Nation, and that is a broader term for the Nerissou. And then there's three different Indigenous communities. And in these short films, you're detailing protests against clear-cutting that affect the traditional territory of the community. It's great to have that background, and also for us to hear a little bit about the context within which you created these short films, both for educational purposes, but also, as I can imagine, to communicate information, to try to help develop a solidarity movement. So thanks so much for sharing about that, Frank.
Yeah, absolutely. If I could say one final thing, is that we'll be producing, well, we have more content on our website, amplifierfilms.ca, including fights for the protection of the Salish Sea in the west coast of so-called North America and Turtle Island. We're currently producing a film making links between colonialism in Palestine and in Turtle Island as well, and people should check that out.
That was a conversation with independent filmmaker Frank Lopez. You can learn more about his projects at amplifierfilms.ca. Frank has been making an effort to document the land-based struggles of the indigenous community of the Nerissou, also known widely as Atikamekw. There's a number of different government
controlled reservations. This is where indigenous communities have been forced to live in territories regulated by both Quebec and Canadian authorities. This whole story of indigenous people protesting the clear-cutting of their traditional lands, a number of people in the community are opposed to this, and them putting up road blockades, I think really speaks to an important present-day illustration of colonialism today. So thanks again to Frank Lopez for the conversation on Free City Radio for this edition. I'm Stefan Christoff, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 90.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., and on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio, and look us up. We're also a podcast. Just tune in. Search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Stefan Christoff, and I'll be back with you next week.